time to get underway with Radio Friendships. Stay tuned as your hosts, Don and Sandra Tipton, share exciting news about what God is doing throughout the world in this missions-minded radio broadcast.
Welcome to Radio Friendships. This is Jeff Reed standing in for Don and Sandra Tipton from Port Mercy in Lake Charles, Louisiana. Well, we'd like to thank you all for joining us today. It's really nice to have you along. Today, we'd like to introduce to you a special guest. He is a pastor, he's an evangelist, he's an author, and he's a brother in Christ. But he is a brother that has a story of encouragement to us all. And that would be Don Piper. Welcome to Radio Friendships, Don.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm honored to be on the program, and I'm certainly very excited about the ministry that the Friendships perform around the world.
Well, I think probably the best place to start would be talking about your book, because that is a good foundation of what we're going to be speaking about, and that would be 90 Minutes in Heaven, which the last time I checked, it was over 2.5 million copies sold, closing in on 3 million. What can you tell us about this book?
Yeah, the original book, paperback edition of 90 Minutes in Heaven, has sold actually 4 million copies now. It's out in a lot of other versions, a hardback edition, and 30 translations worldwide. So it's a book that we had no idea would have this kind of response, and it just keeps going and going and going. And then, of course, I've written a couple more books, a devotional book, and then the new book called Heaven is Real, Lessons on Earthly Joy for those people who are trying to find out how to get through a difficult tragedy or loss. So The whole response to the books has just been phenomenal. It's got to be a God thing, because we had no idea that people would be touched the way they have.
Yeah, and when we get down to the bottom line, it's not really about the book. It's the story that's conveyed in there, an experience that you had. And why don't we start at the beginning? I think you'd be somewhere around Houston going to a Baptist convention.
Yeah.
When was this?
Yeah, I was serving a church south of Houston in a little town called Alvin, and had been on the church staff there for a couple of years. And I went to a conference. You know, ministers are often going to conferences, and I just went to one of those. It lasted for 3 days. And on a Wednesday morning when the conference ended, I'm headed back to my church, about 100 miles away from the conference center. It was a cold, rainy January morning in 1989, and out of the conference center gates, not 10 minutes, I was crossing a rural, narrow bridge, and a tractor-trailer truck, an 18-wheeler, crossed the center stripe and hit me head-on, really just rolled over the top of my car, because I was on a bridge, so I had nowhere to go, and crushed the car with me in it and rolled off the back of it, and I was killed instantly, fatality. Four different sets of emergency medical technicians pronounced me dead on the scene, and I had one of those experiences that you hear people talk about that, frankly, I didn't believe could really happen. Actually, during the time I was pronounced dead, and I was indeed dead here on Earth, I was standing at the gates of heaven, so that lasted about 90 minutes, so I didn't have a near-death experience. I was really actually deceased. So the story of 90 Minutes is really a story of what happened during the time that I was there, and then a long, extremely painful and difficult recovery that took place after I returned to life and to Earth. It's quite a remarkable story, one that you wouldn't want to you wouldn't want to hope for, because it was a very difficult, a long road to get back to where I am today.
Yeah. And as one reads this book, at first you get the impression there's two separate stories here. But really, you see how they're intertwined as well. The experience that you had in heaven, how that carried you through your experiences here on Earth.
Yes. In fact, I didn't talk about the experience I had in heaven for nearly 2 years, because I just didn't really... it was very personal. It was very private. It was one of those things that was such a holy moment for me that I just didn't share it. And when I finally did, I just confided in a friend, and his response was, "Wow, you know, what do you think God allowed you to see that? If you were supposed to keep it a secret, it would seem to me that He would want you to encourage people about the reality of heaven." I heard what he said, but I just didn't agree with it. So it took a long time for me to do that. But you're right. My heaven experience is something that kind of got me through the other thing, because you know, I feel like in a very real sense, as Christians, if we know where we're going, we ought to have a better trip on the way.
Yeah.
And I meet a lot of Christians who are not having a good trip on the way. There's no doubt they've had something terrible happen in their lives. Maybe they've lost a loved one, or they've lost their home, or a hurricane came through and blew everything away, mm-hmm. or, you know, they're going through health issues, and so things are not going well for them, and consequently, they've been knocked down by the circumstances of life. And I know what that's like. I was knocked down, but I decided I wasn't knocked out, and I had to find a way to discover what I call a new normal. I would never be the same way as I was before the truck hit me, but I didn't have to be bitter. I could be better, so a lot of the book, 90 Minutes in Heaven, is finding a new way to live after something that has just changed you completely. I knew I would never walk the same. In fact, they told me I would never walk again. Yeah. I've had 34 operations and spent 13 months in a hospital bed. So a lot of the story is the recovery and finding a new way to live.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about a few of those things, the process that you went through in your recovery. But let's get back to the story. Now, you were pronounced dead by four different officials, did you say?
That's correct. Four. There were actually four vehicles involved in the accident. The large truck that struck me, my car, and two other cars. So there's four vehicles. Consequently, in this very rural area, they were calling for ambulances and police to come out to the scene. They called for four ambulances because they thought there may be four injuries at least. Mm-hmm. As it turned out, gratefully, no one else was hurt except me. And so they were all there. And since there was no one else to work on, they all worked on me. Four different EMTs, you know, did tests on me, examined me, tried to do heroic measures to revive me, but were unable to do so. So I was pronounced dead by all four of them and covered up with a tarp so nobody would have to look at the body because I was quite torn apart. Yeah. It was really a gruesome sight. So they were waiting for a medical examiner to come and sign the paperwork to take the body away.
But something changed. There was a man that was impressed by God to go pray for you, correct?
There was. Since I was coming home from a conference and this accident happened on a bridge, the traffic was backed up for miles. Because this bridge happens to be the only way across a lake. So people back behind me couldn't go anywhere, including a lot of the other ministers who had been to the conference. One of them and his wife walked up to the bridge and just asked if he could pray for somebody because he saw that there had obviously been a terrible accident. And he was told that there was no one to pray for because the other victims were fine and that I was a fatality. And when the policeman said to the pastor, the man in the red car, meaning me, mm-hmm. is a fatality, God spoke to the pastor and said, pray for the man in the red car. Well, that made no sense to him theologically. You know, his belief was, if you're already dead, there's no reason to pray. But he knew God was telling him to do it. So he begged for the right to go over and reach inside the car and put his hand on me and pray for me. And he finally was given permission to do that. So he started praying for me in the car because God had told him to. By this time, my church had been notified that I'd been in an accident, but they were not told I was fatality because they try never to do that on the phone. Mm. They started praying as well and calling a lot of other churches and having them call other churches. So my family was notified that I'd been in an accident, but also not told that I was dead. So in a very short period of time, thousands of people are praying for me, literally, around the world. All of them do not know I'm already dead, except one. That man on the bridge is praying for me. 90 minutes after the truck hit me and killed me, he's under that waterproof tarp with the body with his hand on my shoulder praying for me. And suddenly, without any warning, he's singing a hymn, What a Friend We Have in Jesus. As he's singing that hymn, I started singing the hymn with him.
Wow.
And I was back here on earth.
Wow. After 90 minutes.
Yes, after 90 minutes.
That's a long time for the brain to be without oxygen.
Well, yeah, it's actually a certain death. There's no question that someone couldn't really recover from that unless it be a miracle. And my being here is definitely a miracle. If you see the car and you see my injuries, and I mean, my head was crushed by the roof, and my chest was crushed because the steering wheel kind of crushed my chest. It was just all devastating and fatal injuries. And the fact that I'm here, even though for a long time when I got back, I was barely here, you know, ICU, and as I said, 34 major operations and 13 months in the hospital bed. The journey back has been long and difficult. And I do have, you know, some severe limitations as to what I can do, but it's just amazing that I survived the accident and that I live today. and that I had a chance to glimpse heaven and know just how real it is.
Yeah, well, why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, heaven really actually is the most real thing I've ever experienced, and that's really a pretty heavy statement when you consider what I have experienced. You know, 34 trips to a surgical suite to be operated on, 13 months in a hospital bed. I mean, you can't get much more real than that. Yeah. The pain was off the scale. I didn't know that a human could hurt that badly and live to tell about it. Mm. But as vivid and awesome as that was in terms of being overwhelming, it doesn't compare at all with the grandeur and the majesty of heaven. That's the most real thing I've ever experienced. There really were gates made of pearl. There really was a street made of gold. There were people who surrounded me, who greeted me at the gates, were people who helped me get there, and they were all magnificent in their appearance, without scars, without blemishes, without age. And I've got lots of scars on me, but I didn't have any in heaven. Nobody has scars in heaven except Jesus, to remind the rest of us of how we got there. I heard the wings of angels there, a very comforting, encouraging sound, as they greeted me at the gate and kind of hovered above me. Not all angels have wings, but many of them do. And they're there, and they're quite magnificent. And then there was the music, which I carry with me even to this day, not only in quality, but in quantity. I've never heard so much amazing music rendered at the same time, and yet there was no chaos. I could distinguish each one of the songs with my heavenly ears. So heaven is really a sensory explosion of sight and sound and touch and taste and aroma. It is ultimate reality, and it was, and it is, and it will be. This earth, this radio program that we're having, it will pass. It will be over, yeah. But heaven endures forever. I can't wait to go back there. I certainly didn't want to come back here, but I didn't get that choice.
Even though you probably retold this story many times, there's still got to be a search for words to really describe it.
It is. One of the most frustrating aspects of talking about heaven in particular is that we're having to do it with earthly words, and nothing about heaven is earthly. It is a completely different place. I wouldn't even call it a world. And it really is a place. You know, Jesus said in John chapter 14, as he was talking to his followers, right on the threshold of his own death, you know, so Jesus understands death and pain because he went through an extraordinary amount of pain. No one else had ever endured anything quite like it or since. Mm-hmm. He said to them, when one of them asked him, "Where are you going now?" In other words, you're about to die, because he told them that he was. And where are you going, and how do we get there? Jesus had just said, "I'm going to prepare a place for you," meaning heaven itself. And Thomas said, "Well, we don't know where you're going. We don't know how to get there." Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except through me." So heaven really is a place. He even says, "I go to prepare, in my Father's house are many mansions or rooms." Everywhere that heaven is talked about, it's talked about as a city or a kingdom or a place. There are gates, there are streets. It's actually more real than anything I've ever seen here on earth, mm-hmm. because it's eternal, and what we have here is not eternal. So, and it's extraordinarily difficult to describe the majesty and the brilliance and the vividness of heaven, because we just don't have any words here that do it justice. It's quite incredible and awesome, and I can't wait to go back.
Yeah. You know, one other thing, I've interviewed a couple other people that had some experiences like this, and they said there was no sense of time whatsoever.
None. No.
No tick of the clock.
Time is really an earthly manifestation. You know, the Bible uses the expression over and over again, "in the fullness of time." And that really is an earthly manifestation. Now, Jesus was born in the fullness of time. He came right on time. But in heaven, there is no time. Now, I will say that it's linear in a sense that, you know, action is propelled forward. It's not frozen. I mean, it's not that there's no sense that things are moving, but there is no passage of time because there is no night there. Mm. There's no, I mean, everything is brilliant and bright. There is no need for rest because you never get tired. That's an earthly manifestation. No pain, no tears, no dying, no suffering, no parting. In heaven, we never say goodbye. We only say hello, because people are you're continuing to meet people who have gone before you and who will come after you until the end of time. So it is a timeless place in that sense. There is no passage of time. I could have been there for 90 years or 90 seconds. it just so happened I was away from Earth for 90 minutes, therefore the name of the book, 90 Minutes in Heaven. But you don't sense any time is passing there whatsoever. You'll never find a wristwatch or a clock or anything else in heaven because you don't need it. You have all the time of eternity. You could talk to Paul, the apostle. You could talk to Moses. You can talk to... You'll just never run out of time to visit with them, and they'll never run out of time to visit with you. It's heaven.
But it didn't stop there. Like you said, you came back into a body full of pain. I'm sure this guy praying for you at the time was pretty shocked.
Well, he was stunned. It changed his life. You know, he prayed for a dead man because God told him to do it, and then I lived. And so, yes, the way he approached his ministry, the way he approached his prayer life, the way he approached his witnessing life, was radically changed from that moment forward. And so it revolutionized his ministry, as well as when I finally figured out why I survived, you know, what I could do. And I've spent my time since then trying to invite people into heaven. I want to try to be a witness to let people know that heaven is real and God answers prayer. I'm a living testimony to answer prayer.
Yes.
God's still in the miracle business. I think we have a tendency to think that's something that used to happen but no longer happens, but I think God's doing better miracles now than he even did in Bible times. I see them all the time. And also that sometimes things happen to you and you're never the same after that. You have to find a new way to live. And I want to encourage people to know that even though you might not be the same, you don't have to be worse. I try to tell them that they can find a way to turn their mess into a message that might bless somebody else and to take their pain and turn it into a purpose. And so I've spent the better part of my life since the accident and the recovery trying to encourage people who've been knocked down and hurt deeply and are really struggling with their life. And because I know what that feels like, and I'm still a work in progress. You know, every day I still have to get up and deal with, you know, broken bones and things that don't work very well. But I'm going to go as long as I can and try to populate heaven and also try to give hope to people who are in hopeless situations.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of that process that you went through in your recovery, because I think that's very important as well. Again, you know, there was this struggle with being back into your physical body after experiencing the splendor and the brilliance of heaven, but also the pain. But there were some other things in your book that I thought were pretty important, something that you had to overcome, and that was allowing others to help you.
I was a minister. I was pastor. I think sometimes caregivers are the world's worst people for allowing other people to give them care. You know, you dedicate your life, whether you're a physician or a minister or, you know, a nurse, you know, whatever it is that you do, where you're just basically responsible for trying to meet other people's needs, suddenly you're utterly helpless yourself. You can't do a thing. And, I mean, I really literally could not do anything for myself at all. I was completely helpless. And I really became kind of withdrawn. I just wished people would go away and leave me alone. They were trying to be nice. They were trying to be comforting and helpful. And, of course, I looked awful. I felt awful. I just wished I could kind of get over it on my own and then kind of someday emerge on the other side of it. And yet they persisted in trying to help me, and I didn't really do a very good job of allowing them to do that. I had a retired pastor friend of mine who just basically read me the riot act. I mean, he just got in my face and told me that I needed to change my attitude. Only someone like him could have really gotten my attention that way. I mean, he was in his 80s and, you know, he didn't have anything to lose. An old retired pastor, he just kind of tell you the truth. He just kind of let me know that I was doing a poor job of allowing other people to help me. And my response to that was, I don't want them to help me. I wish they would go away and leave me alone. And he says, well, your problem is that you're a hypocrite. They want to help you, and you won't let them. You've been helping them most of your life, and now this is the only thing they have to give you. They want to do this. It means something to them to be able to be meaningful to you. It's not about you. It's about them. And he really kind of helped me see that I was looking at this the wrong way. And so, you know, they weren't enormous things, but, you know, a glass of water, something to read, they would bring me, sometimes even a milkshake or something. I lost 85 pounds. And it meant so much to them to help me that I realized that I was depriving them of a blessing. And I had tried to bless them all my life, and now they were trying to bless me, and I wasn't allowing them to do it. It was a real wake-up call for me. It was a real revelation. Mm-hmm. a very emotional catharsis for me to realize that sometimes when somebody wants to help you, the best thing you can say is yes, because it means something to them. Mm-hmm. It's not about you. So yes, I had to get hit by a big truck to figure that out, but I'm kind of thick, but I finally got it, and I'm better at it now than I was then. And I want to encourage people who think they're independent and don't need anybody else. Sometimes allowing them to help you, it means more to them than it even does to you. So, yeah. Kind of a learning experience, but I understand it better now than I did then.
It sounds like it came full circle for you anyways. You loved to help people. Now you needed to learn to let people help you. But now it turned around again because through this device, this contraption, how do you say that thing that was on your leg?
It's an Elizarov. It's invented by a Russian doctor. It's a bone growth device. Yeah, through the device, I spent a good deal of time. In the past few weeks, I have been with four different patients who are wearing the bone stretching devices that involve metal halos that surround the arms and legs. Sometimes they put them on your neck if you've broken your neck. Mm-hmm. And they turn screws on these things to stretch the bones that are missing to replace the bones that are no longer there. And it's quite an ingenious device, but it's excruciatingly painful and difficult to live with. The good news is they told me I would never walk again and that I would never use my left arm again because I'd lost all the bones in it. But today I am walking and I'm using my left arm. And it's because of this miraculous contraption, this miraculous medical technology. But it was an extraordinarily difficult thing. I wore the one on my leg for 11 months, and the one on my arm for 8 months.
Wow.
But now I'm in a unique position to minister to people who wear them because no one had ever had one put on that part of their leg before me here in the United States. I was the first. And so I'm kind of a go-to guy now when somebody's getting one. I talked to a 16-year-old boy yesterday who is getting one installed, who was in a traffic accident up in Ohio. And, of course, someone told him about the book, and his parents called me, and I talked to him to try to reassure him about what he's facing. Same thing with a girl that I met here who was in a boating accident. And just 4 weeks ago, a young man about 17 walked up to me wearing one and just put his arms around me and cried. That's all he wanted to do. Because he wanted to meet somebody else who understood how he felt.
Yes.
So I've been in the position now to try to help people who are really hurting and give them some hope about what their life's going to be after this is over.
Hey, man, and that is such a comfort to know somebody understands at that point.
It is. Isn't that what we all want?
I mean, exactly.
When we're going through a real tragedy or a loss or a difficulty, we just want somebody to say, I know how you feel. And mean it. I mean, not just say it because they're trying to make us feel better, but because now we can look at them and say, well, you know what? They made it, so maybe I can make it too. That's what we're looking for.
And most importantly, we have someone always with us that knows everything that we've been through, and that is our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, Don, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I was deeply honored to be asked on your program. I believe in the friendships, and I'm just delighted to have been here. I say to people as I leave them, I'm always saying goodbye to people here on earth, but one day we'll only say hello. That's what you say in heaven. So if I don't see you here, I'll see you at the gate.
Amen. Well, we thank you all for joining us today on Radio Friendships. Be sure to join us again tomorrow when we continue our interview with Don Piper. Until then, this is Radio Friendships inviting you back to the place where we love to speak about the great and mighty God and the many wonderful ways throughout the world to serve Him. Have a great day and join us again tomorrow.
Friendships provides disaster relief, medical services, and humanitarian aid. All staff are volunteer and there's no charge to participate. Looking for a meaningful way to spend your days and an effective way to serve God? All skills are needed, willing hearts of all ages. If you're a recent high school graduate and would like to learn about relief missions while seeking God's will for your life, ask about our apprenticeship program. Medical personnel, register with us for international missions. Friendships. Live the dream.
Thank you for listening to the Friendships broadcast today. Don and Sandra Tipton invite you to join them again next time as we stand in awe of the great God we serve. Friendships is based at Port Mercy in Lake Charles, Louisiana. For information about Friendships Unlimited, dial 337-433-4444. 5022 or go on the internet to friendships.org.